Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. It's my great pleasure today to be joined by Dr. Andy Rodham, who is the CEO of Our Future Health, which we're going to be hearing all about. And he is doing that after a background as an epidemiologist and a data and statistics veteran in the pharma industry. Andy, welcome to the pod.
Chris, thank you. Great to be here.
So, Our Future Health, that's a very big title for an organization. It's a very big vision. Bring that vision to life for us. What are you doing, and what will the UK and the world look like if you succeed?
So Our Future Health is really designed to be one of the UK's largest ever health research programs, and really it's sort of founded against trying to tackle the problem of the ever-growing challenge around chronic diseases in mid to later life. So, you know, if you look back in time a little bit over the past sort of 15 to 20 years, there's been a huge advance in medicine. There's huge advances in the sort of diagnostic spaces. But today, or even now, we still have, you know, significant numbers of people who are suffering ill health in later life, and often suffering it because we're diagnosing conditions later than we should. We're getting to people and treating them when they end up with things like a stage 3 or a stage 4 cancer. Dementias we only pick up at the point when they start to be clinically visible, and it's really difficult to start to treat those individuals at that point. And really what Our Future Health has been sort of established to start to deliver against is, how do you start to address some of these problems and challenges? And how do you really start to think about being more targeted in the sort of public health world, you know, compared to what we've seen sort of the advances within the medical world and the treatment world, particularly if you think about sort of targeted interventions around cancer therapeutics. So what we're trying to do is build a new research platform, and to build a new research platform that really capitalizes on the areas today in the world that we know are going to be important in the future. And that sort of brings together the ideas around data and all of the ideas around machine learning, artificial intelligence. What can you learn from the data that typically you would never see before? The worlds of genomics and, you know, what we know about genetics of common diseases, and how you utilize our genetics of common diseases to better understand those people who are going to be at highest risk. So, you know, moving towards the sort of predictive high impact sort of targeting of individuals for interventions, for screening programs and others. And then also capitalizing on the fact that people have much more control and much more passive collection of data than they ever have before. So when we think about Fitbits, Apple Watches, Garmins, and all of the other things that people have, how we can capitalize and bring all of that together in a platform that people can actually come along and start to do interventions, research, and other aspects to, or other types of things that can, and interventions that can really transform how healthcare looks in the future.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot going on there, right? So we're talking about detecting diseases earlier, about understanding those diseases better for things like personalized treatments, about building a much richer data picture of what's going on. And as you said, then making, I guess, earlier and much more targeted interventions in people's lives. Just super pragmatically, like, what do you do to get that? So you talked about building this research platform. What are the ingredients of that research platform?
So the biggest ingredient is people. So the plan for the platform is to recruit 5 million individuals across the UK to truly represent the diversity of the population living in the UK as well. And that's not just ethnic diversities, it's also the location, socio-demographic diversity, age, and all of the other sort of things that you can think of which really make the population of this country really rich. And with those 5 million people, you know, to achieve that goal means that we have to be very pragmatic about how you try to collect data on them. So we try to minimize the sort of data collection up front. So we're trying to work with the NHS, particularly on how we can recruit people as part of a routine appointment they already have, whether that's things like going to their GP or going along to a blood donation or a hospital. We collect the sort of biological material from those individuals at that point to simplify the sort of process and minimize the sort of requirements on individuals to take part. And we then ask certain questions of them online, in websites or apps or other mechanisms to capture other information about them.
Got it. And so biological material, let's just double click on that. That sounds a little bit sinister, maybe. Like, what are we what are we talking, flesh or kind of blood or sweat or tears?
A little bit of blood, as they're going to have a blood test done. So we're working to look at those people who are going along for a blood test. We'll take an extra tube of blood at the very end of the research. And then their ordinary sort of sample goes off. We're also looking at to make it even easier for people to take part collecting saliva from them at home, so they don't even have to necessarily come along to a blood test, particularly for some of the groups which might be harder to get to, possibly geographically or because of work and other commitments, that we sort of ease the ability to take part in the study and maximise the potential for the whole population to join.
Okay, so people and their, you know, if they choose to opt in, they give a sample, that might be blood, that might be saliva. And then through a process of incredible alchemy, it still seems to me every day, we somehow turn that blood or that saliva into data by sequencing it. And what happens then? So we've got people, we've turned blood or saliva into data. What else do we need to kind of bake this cake?
We need really a collaborative environment of researchers who are going to come along and start to ask the really interesting questions. You know, what is it that you should be doing differently? What do we understand about people who have high risks of certain diseases? How do you calculate the risks of certain diseases? How do you start to look for patterns amongst individuals? So if you see people who have particular genetic sort of makeup, how do they look different from people who have a slightly different makeup? Do they all do the same things? Do some people respond better to some interventions than others? So part of what we're doing is building the resource, and then we're building the environment to bring together the researchers, the companies, academics, clinicians, who will start to use the resource in anger with some of the really hard questions that we want to test, and also start to be able to test new things out on that group of people. So one of the things we'll do when we're building the resources, we'll get consent from the individuals to be able to go back to them and invite them to take part in further research studies. So if a company or an academic or a clinician has a really great idea that they want to be able to test out, we'll have a ready prepared group of people who will meet those sort of characteristics, whether that's age, location, disease, history, that we can invite to take part in that research. So really then accelerating that sort of discovery and interventional research that people would want to do to bring forward the discoveries that will change the future.
And so do you have a perspective on what the most important questions are, or is your view like, we're building this thing, it's an incredible asset for the public health of the UK and for research and so on, and anyone who, I guess, is like signed off by an ethics committee and is kind of doing valuable research can come and do whatever they want on it? Or do you say, right, we know that, you know, I'm making it up, cancer and Alzheimer's are two big things for the first kind of 5 years, and then we're going to do what else? You know, how are you thinking about what questions people are working on?
Well, so a couple of thoughts. I think one, it is a massively important public health asset for the country and the world to be able to bring this together. So at some level, we become agnostic to the diseases that we sort of would approve, providing, you know, as you said, they meet the sort of ethics approvals and have all the necessary sort of steps in place to make it a valid application. However, there are some areas quite naturally that fall out as being probably the ones that will get most studied early on in the program. And I think two that you picked are absolutely true, cancer and the dementias. Lots and lots of interest with all of, even in the setup phases we're in the moment, there's a huge amount of interest from companies, from researchers, from the charities around how this research resource can really be targeted towards being most useful to those sort of disease areas. And that might include some additional measurements we make on parts of the resource. It might include being targeted in who we recruit first and how we sort of set that sort of up so that we can sort of see some early areas. I think other areas that have come up as being of great interest, the sort of predictive prevention area around how might you target people for preventive activities earlier, risk scoring sort of areas, particularly in cardiovascular, how could that play out? What about sort of starting to do that intervention earlier? So if you knew someone has a very high risk, but they're in a younger age group than we might typically intervene in, how could that really play through? So a number of conversations in that space. But I think ultimately the resource is really to cover everything and any disease that's of interest to individuals where we would have sufficient numbers to be able to make a difference.
So the cardiovascular example is a really interesting one, right? And at Genomics England, we're obsessed with this kind of infinity loop and the link between healthcare delivery, which generates kind of data and understanding about people. Then we can feed that data through into research and we can do all sorts of research. But then critically, we feed that the outcomes of that research back into healthcare. And so I think this is what we're getting to here, right? That we've got we recruit the people, we get the data, we give the opportunities to follow up. Researchers kind of beaver away and figure out smart stuff on top of that research asset. And to some extent, there's an output of that, which is research papers, like, you know, Biobank has like now hit over 1,000 research papers, amazing. But then there's also this output of that, which is actual interventions in the healthcare system, right? And I think you mentioned screening, so figuring out who we should screen, maybe when they're 30 rather than when they're 40 or 50 for, I guess, things like breast cancer or so on. And you mentioned cardiovascular, right? So how would that kind of research feed into a different way of either screening for or kind of assessing or treating someone with, you know, a high risk of cardiovascular disease or a heart attack?
So I think where we can play a real role there is the sort of middle ground. If you think about how most interventions tend to get scaled into clinical practice today, they're often done, they're discovered at a very small scale. And then there's a little bit of magic which goes into suddenly saying that actually they could work at a larger scale. But really what you need are very large scale demonstration trials, studies, interventions to say what is the right way to do this. You know, I think a great example at the moment is the sort of NHS GRAIL partnership that was announced, you know, a new type of study looking at something really very different as a sort of potential intervention for cancer detection, but needing to be able to demonstrate that at a very large scale of numbers of people that are recruited. And again, because we'll have a very, very large cohort, which you'll be able to find those people really easily, accelerate the ability to kind of deploy those new types of technologies, interventions, and get the follow-up data because we've already built the sort of linkages with the health system and all of the sort of magic data that pops out of the NHS at the end of appointments and visits and interactions. You know, that's where I think we sort of play that key role of sort of being able to show that large scale impact. And then you can start to test what do you do with a 30-year-old who's at high risk of cardiovascular disease? Do you intervene or not? And if you intervene, what do you intervene with? Do you intervene with something digital and tell them to make sure they do twice the exercise everybody else does because that's going to be better for them than giving them a statin at 30. Yeah, I think they're all the questions that the research community needs to come up with. And we can provide the sort of large scale platform to really test those and truly understand the evidence that comes out of that so that it can form policy in the future.
Got it. So just to double click on the GRAIL thing. So I'm conscious not everyone will be familiar with GRAIL, which is a really smart company that is trying to detect cancer from the blood even before anyone actually shows any signs of actually having cancer. So we're kind of getting ahead of even stage one of cancers. But to give everyone in the country GRAIL blood tests, you know, once a year or something, I imagine would equate to like the GDP of a small country or something. And so what you're saying is that we need to figure out who we make these kind of interventions with, right? So how do we choose which members of which populations should be screened for cancer, for cardiovascular, and so on? Okay, brilliant. And so we start to get closer to that vision of a lifelong relationship with kind of health data that allows us to, rather than waiting for someone to actually have a heart attack and present at A&E, get kind of upstream of that and focus on the health and the wellness. Okay, cool. So a couple of bits I'd love to double click on. One is you talked about recruiting 5 million people and trying to make that as representative of the UK as possible. I'd love to talk about how we think about that. And then maybe a bit about why is the UK well positioned to do this, and what does this mean for kind of UK PLC? So let's think first about this point about 5 million people. 5 million people is kind of almost 10% of the UK, right? It's a pretty staggering number of people. And, you know, there've been tiny countries like Iceland or Estonia or something where you start to see those kind of that proportion of the population taking part in these kind of things. How do we figure out what representative looks like? I mean, you're a statistician and an epidemiologist by background, right? So this is your bread and butter, I guess. But like, how do we know who to call?
That's a really good question, and probably one of the more technically challenging ones we have to do to get to 5 million people. So there are a few different answers. I think ultimately, truly representative is something we'll never ever get to, because it's really, really hard to get a true representation of everybody. You can be very generalizable and you can be very inclusive. And that's truly where we're trying to get to, which is how do we reach populations across the four nations in all of the different groups, ages, men, women, who will typically be in the sort of health system ultimately over time. And there's lots of ways to start to think about that. So we know that when you start to look at sort of attendances at certain services within the NHS, there are particular ways that you can look at numbers who come through, and you can start to see that, you know, people who turn up in hospitals broadly represent the population of the UK, and to people who turn up for outpatients. We know that people who go along for what is the NHS health check, so a sort of 40 to 74 year old health checkup that is offered by your GPs, when you look at that on aggregate across the UK, it's broadly representative of the population who you've invited along to that appointment. So I think at one level, it's kind of being targeted around those sort of opportunities where we know the sort of baseline population is broadly representative. And then being really, really focused around understanding why people may or may not be agreeing to take part in research, or why there may be barriers to people taking part in research.
Let's pause on that for a second. So there's a lot of talk at the moment, we're recording this in March of 2021, around vaccine hesitancy in the context of COVID, right? We might think of this, I guess, as like research hesitancy. It's not necessarily that people are anti-medical research, but for a bunch of communities, there are a whole host of very real historical reasons why people might worry about injustice, or about what happens to their blood samples, what happens to their data, and so on. How can we better understand that hesitancy and, I guess, have a kind of peer-to-peer or kind of adult-to-adult conversation with people who have that hesitancy to try and address that?
It's all about sort of engaging with the communities you're trying to recruit, which is, you know, as you said, is exactly what the sort of vaccine work is doing at the moment, to understand why are people not taking an offer of a vaccine. And to date, we've done double figures worth of focus groups. We're a few hundred sort of members of the public over the past few months since this program started, where we started to explore attitudes towards participation in research, involvement of companies, the NHS, government, local authorities. Lots of people, lots of different groups have lots of different reasons why they want to partake in research or don't, and have lots of different allegiances to sort of bodies. So it really, the only way we'll be successful is to really engage with the people who we're trying to recruit, understand what it is that's making them or stopping them taking part in research, and trying to see how we can design and deliver the program in a way that will help. You know, from simple things like if people are asked to go and do an appointment from 9 to 5, but they have a 9 to 5 job, it's really hard for them to take part in research. So we have to think about how we optimize, you know, from trivial to really complex issues around sort of personal perceptions and beliefs around, you know, other bodies who might be involved in this.
Yeah, huge. And you mentioned there this point about the difference between academic research and kind of industry research, like startups, biotech, you know, tier one global pharma. This is a knotty question which people have been engaging their brains on for a while. What are you learning about views on how best to strike these partnerships with commercial players. And in fact, having just asked a question, let me just share a bias here, which is I think we need to, I'm interested in how you think we can have a kind of proactive conversation with, quote unquote, the public, which of course doesn't exist, right? But with the various segments of the population who have different views on this. There is a really fundamental point, which is sick people want to get well. The treatments that help sick people to get well come from biotech and pharma companies. And yet there is this very, very strong hesitancy about working with biotech and pharma companies to help them develop those treatments because of perceptions of, I don't know, either excess profit or like, is this in the public interest or not? How can we unpick this really tangled knot?
It's a really great question. And, you know, partly something we've had to tackle head on. So, you know, the program that I'm running is funded through the Industrial Strategy Challenge Fund. So a sort of condition of the funding is that we need to form partnerships with the pharma biotech companies to kind of co-establish the program, co-fund the sort of establishment of it. So, you know, from day one, we've been in conversations with the public about what is it that the program needs to look like to recruit them into the program, being very open that industry, pharma industry, biotech, and even the technology sectors are going to be heavily involved in this design, delivery, and build. Well, there's a few thoughts. So we've done some focus group work with the public on, you know, what's the relationship going to look like? What do they get for taking part? How do they access the data? What protection, security, controls we place on that? And on the whole, when you start to go through in detail the sort of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to achieve, what it is that's going to happen as a result of this, there's general acceptance that actually the partnerships make sense. That you do, you know, it's not a one size fits all, you know, the government can fund everything or the NHS can fund everything or the industry should do everything. And actually the balance that we've struck between, you know, being able to deliver something at scale, being able to do something as big as this and to do it in a way that will ultimately improve the lives of people in the future. And, you know, you start to talk about, you know, how the medicines are developed or how the diagnostics are developed or how the interventions are developed. And people on the whole to date have sort of come to the appreciation that that is something that's a reality of how we do research, but have always had lots of questions around the controls, the sort of protections. And, you know, I think it's going to be a delicate balance over the time we deliver this program that, you know, on the one side, people are going to be concerned and worried, and we have to be really careful about and concerned about that and the data securities, safeties and protections of their of them as individuals.
I will be watching with strong interest as you have those conversations, because I think there's a fundamental point about altruism about taking part in research, but there's also a fundamental point about reciprocity. And I know that if I take part in this research, it's going to benefit people like me, even if it's not necessarily going to benefit me myself, but it might benefit my community, whether that community is diabetes sufferers or whether that community is South Asian men or, you know, whatever it is. But there's a really important point there about fairness as well, right? And fairness, of course, can mean different things to different people. So a tightrope walk, for sure. Speaking of industrial strategy, grand challenges, and the pharma industry, and doing these things at scale, I was listening to the Today programme on a Saturday morning not long ago, and the interviewer was pressuring Michael Gove on, right, you know, now we're out of the EU, and we seem to be aligning all of this regulation with the EU to smooth borders and trade and so on, which makes a ton of sense. But if we're just going to align everything with the EU, then why did we bother leaving? You know, what are the things that we're going to do differently now that we're, you know, a sort of plucky, nation state doing this? Literally the first word out of Michael Gove's mouth was genomics. I just sort of spluttered into my morning coffee as he said, well, you know, genomics, the life sciences industry, you know, this is Britain at its best, you know, Darwin, Rosalind Franklin, Crick and Watson, Sanger, you know, and thought, wow, okay, no pressure. If we see this whole ecosystem in the UK, biotech, pharma, the universities, the NHS, the government, organisations like Genomics England and Our Future Health, what is it about the UK that means we can do these things? It's like UK Biobank, huge global impact, you know, Genomics England, moonshot kind of project back in 2013-14, Our Future Health, you know, ramping up the level of ambition to 5 million. Why can we do this here? And like, how does it work? And what role is Our Future Health going to play in kind of continuing to build that ecosystem?
I think there's lots of different answers to that. So I think one, you sort of alluded to it, you know, we've done it before as a country and we've shown what's possible, you know, going back, you know, I would go all the way back into the 1940s with the birth cohorts that started after the Second World War, the British Doctors study, which ran for 50 years and showed the impact of smoking on disease. You know, fast forward through to the study I worked on when I was a researcher in Oxford with the Million Women study, which is still probably one of the biggest prospective cohorts in certainly in this country and around the world today, with 1.3 million people recruited and followed over time. And, you know, Biobank, Gel, Alspac, and many, many others. So the ability and the knowledge and the expertise that the country has in how you do these types of research programs. And you then start to couple that with the NHS and the data that you can see around individuals, the sort of cradle to grave record, something which is unparalleled and not seen pretty much anywhere else in the world at the scale which you have in the UK. And then I think the foresight and investments that we've seen, the you know, Genomics England, everyone never thought would take off back in 2000 and whatever it was when it was first started. You know, would you ever get to 100,000 people with whole genome sequences? And then, you know, you look at the sort of corollary of, well, what happened during COVID and who discovered the most sequences and what proportion of sequences now around the COVID virus come from the UK. You know, I think the ambition that we have, the sort of expertise and delivery that we've got, and the value that people can see that comes from having this sort of well-curated collections of data really set us apart globally from most other countries. And, you know, I say that not just as the chief exec of this program, but having worked in the pharma companies where, you know, I was responsible for a large part about the sort of real world data that we would access. The UK remain one of the leading data sets that you'd be able to come back to and look at.
Absolutely. So the vision is huge. The pace is impressive. Is drawing together this this great ecosystem in the UK. Maybe to the flip side, what are you most worried about? What keeps you up at night?
Well, I think some of the things that I've sort of mentioned. So the worries about how you get 5 million people to take part, being completely clear about what the program is and isn't doing, what is possible and isn't possible, not over-promising and under-delivering, the sort of whole security and protection aspect around data. You know, you can imagine a 5 million database with all of their health data, lots of other records in there that we've asked people, their genetic information, the risks of how you do that. So, you know, how you get to 5 million people, occasionally wake up in the cold sweat about in the middle of the night. People just tell me it's easy. You know, I can put it on a page of, I have a slide, which I say, this is what we're going to do. And underneath that slide is about 4 years worth of work for about 200 people. you know, I think it's an absolutely achievable target, but there are a huge amount of things we've got to do and learn along the way about how to make this a reality, how to keep 5 million people engaged. And it is the intersection between, you know, what is a research program, what is a large scale sort of health program, and also that sort of public facing, consumerized thing of how you keep 5 million people connected and engaged into a community over time.
So never a dull moment, in short. I mean, I don't want to, you're looking a little bit too fresh-faced, so just in the spirit of keeping you up a bit more at night, I retweeted something last night which was put together by an outfit called Atlas VPN, who monitor health data breaches. Apparently in 2020, there were 37 billion data records that were compromised, which was a 140% increase from the 15 billion records that were compromised in 2019. So, you know, the risk is real, right? And I mean, this is, and I say this partly just to have company in misery, because I mean, that's what keeps me up at night about Genomics England as well, right? It's huge. Good, so I'm glad that's a big focus. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time today, and best of luck with the extremely ambitious program that you've outlined for us today.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.